Howdy. I am delighted to have the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. My name again is Arthur Nunes Harwit, and the title of my talk is Advice About Debugger Construction. Just to provide the background, okay, so if you're coming along and you want to write an interpreter and you're new to the game, you can go to Abelson and Sussman's Structured Interpretation of Computer Programs, or if you're a Connellist guy, you can go to Peter Norvig's Paradigms of AI Programming, and we'll show you a little interpreter so you can see how to go about writing an interpreter. So I was interested not only in writing an interpreter, but also writing a debugger along with it. And those books didn't tell me how to do that, so I went to the drawing board. Okay, so the goals, in some sense, were fairly modest. And that is, I simply want to implement step and next. And this is sort of a fib. I also want a third command. I want continue. But continue, what continue does is just keep on running the program until it finishes. And step and next is the interesting part. So step, as you'll see in a moment, takes me a little ways through my program, just a little bit, a step. And next jumps over bigger portions. However, two constraints. I wanted to have an implementation that was efficient and correct. Okay, so, well, what do I mean by efficient? So you can already see that I'm more of a maybe a scheme guy than a Connellist guy. But as you'll see, I also have a theoretical bent. And from a theoretical perspective, maybe one approach to implementing, say, next would be to just make sure that I got step working and then say, okay, well, step is working, so I'll just implement next on top of that. And that wouldn't be so efficient because I'd be stopping all the time. I wouldn't be running at full speed. They say, well, I don't know, that sort of sounds like a straw man. Who would say such a thing? But not mentioning any names, I've actually heard other people talk like that. So, not the only one. Okay, so in terms of correctness, I want to make sure that step and next actually do the right thing, and for that, I'm going to need a specification, of course. So before jumping to swiftly into the details of the specification and all the rest, let me just show you an example of the sort of thing I have in mind. So, okay, so fact is just a factorial function. Here we have we're sitting in the debugger, and this marker over here is indicating that I'm sitting before the factorial of 5. Okay, and so I take a step, and now I'm sitting in front of fact. I take another step, I'm sitting after fact. Another step, I'm sitting in front of the 5. Another step, I'm sitting after the 5. I take another step, and now I'm sitting inside, sitting right before the if. Take another step, now I'm sitting in front of this test portion. Now, I'm not so interested in going through the details of that test, so I'll say next, and that takes me right to the end of the whole thing. So this maybe gives you a better idea of what I mean when I'm talking about step and next. Step takes me in a very fine-grained fashion. Next jumps over whole expressions. Okay, and then at the end I say continue and I get the answer. Okay. So, yep, I'm going to have to give a specification. Before I give the specification, let me say a little bit about
what sort of specification I'm going to give, I'm going to go ahead and use this lambda calculus stuff.
And the reason why is for a variety of reasons. One is that it's simple. I don't want to have to deal with the entire complexity of common Lisp. It's a big ball of mud, as they say. I don't want to have to deal with all of that. In fact, I don't even want to have to deal with all the complexity of scheme. Scheme's a lot smaller. So I have just a very, very small language, right? So I've got constants, I've got variables, and I've got abstractions and lambda expressions. So you can read that lambda just like, for the most part, lambda in scheme, or sharp quote lambda in common Lisp, if you like. And so an expression in my language is either one of these values or an application. And again, a simplification here, I've only got one variable here in terms of parameters. Okay, the other thing over here, and this is incredibly useful, is this evaluation context. And what this is all about is what you would say to explain to somebody how a Lisp expression evaluates. So if you're talking to somebody and trying to explain to them how a Lisp expression gets evaluated, you don't talk about the details of the Pentium assembly language that gets generated. Okay, so rather, and we could take a look at this example, we'd say, okay, well, here's an expression that I'm interested in evaluating. Okay, well, you know, I can't quite yet evaluate this application because I don't yet know what this is over here, and I can't quite evaluate this application of successor because I haven't evaluated this one yet. And so what I have is this evaluation context where this successor of zero goes in the hole, where these brackets indicate a hole here. Here's the hole, and an expression goes in the hole such as this. And when I'm doing evaluation, I say, okay, well, if I'm evaluating this expression, first thing that I need to do is evaluate this part over here, the successor of zero. And that's one, okay. And so the whole thing, if I'm simplifying this whole thing, I have this evaluation context on the outside, and that simplifies to having all this stuff with a one replacing where the successor of zero was. And that's how we think about it. When we think about programming, that's what's nice about programming Lisp. We really can think about it a lot of the time in terms of programming or transforming the language itself, rather than thinking in terms of translating it to machine language and thinking, well, what is the machine doing? Okay. Something else that's incredibly useful about these evaluation contexts is that it turns out that not only is this explaining what's going on in terms of evaluation, and the way we'd explain it to somebody else, is actually telling us what the continuation is. That E is the continuation. Okay. And that's going to make everything go here. So here's my debugger specification, and it's great. It fits entirely on one slide. That's the whole thing. So here we're using these evaluation contexts, and what they're saying is, okay, if I use this dot here to indicate that I'm sitting at a particular place in my code, that I'm in my debugger and I'm sitting at a particular place in my code. So if I'm sitting in my debugger in front of an application, and I take a step, I type in the step command, then what's going to happen is I move in a little bit. Okay, so then I'm sitting in my debugger in front of the first expression in that application. Okay, over here, if I'm sitting in front of a value instead, say a variable, a number, whatever it is, just hop right over that. There's nothing else to do. Okay. If I'm sitting after a value, just move over a little bit. So I'm sitting in front of the next expression.
And that's if I'm in the middle here. If I'm in the middle. If I get to the end, then I want to be sitting after, and I take a step, I want to be sitting after the value. Which value? The value that this expression evaluates to. So if you remember, like successor of 0, if I'm sitting after that 0 and I take a step, I want to be sitting after the 1. Okay. Whereas, if what I've got over here is not a constant operator, like successor, but rather an abstraction, a lambda expression, like our identity function in the previous slide, then what I want to do is I want to go ahead and move in front of this expression n, okay, where this expression n is what happens when I substitute v for x in this body. In other words, when I go ahead and do, when I simplify this application of this lambda expression to this value, I get some other expression, and that's what's going to be sitting here, and I want to have my debugger sitting right out in front. So in a couple of slides ago, when I was sitting after the 5 in my factorial of 5, and then I typed in a step, it moved me right into the function that is if equals n0 and so on. Okay, so that's step. That's all there is to it, just 5 definitions. Next needs even fewer definitions. Okay, so if I'm sitting in front of an expression and I type in a next, then I'm sitting after what that expression evaluates to. Okay. On the other hand, if I'm sitting after a value that's at the end, I go ahead and evaluate that, and then I'm sitting after that value. On the other hand, if I'm sitting in the middle, I'm going to do the same thing as I did before. That is, I'm going to just move over to the next column. Okay, so now let me tell you about the theoretical implementation. So the theoretical implementation is based on this construction called a CEK machine. And it's really very nice. Very nice machine. Because this is actually something you might want to implement. Okay. Before, when we were talking about the lambda calculus and these rewrite rules, that's not a way that you'd actually want to implement something like Lisp. But this is something where you really might implement Lisp in this way. And I'll actually show on a more practical slide, I'll show how I actually did something like that. Okay. So what is the CEK machine? Well, we've got this triple, and this consists of the code that we're interested in executing. We've got an environment here, so we don't have to worry about substitutions and all that stuff. Okay, we've got an environment. And finally, here's our control stack, our continuation.
And the CEK machine is defined just entirely by these rules down here. That's all there is to a CEK machine. Okay. One thing I want to point out, you notice a couple of these rules, it says if V is not in variables. Why does it say that? So this piece of code here, there's no distinction between whether or not this piece of code here, this is the expression that's in here, is actually something that needs to be evaluated or something that has been evaluated. So when we encounter something like a variable that's a value, we want to make sure that the variable gets looked up in the environment. So when we're dealing with these situations, when we've got some value over here, we want to make sure that we actually go ahead and, if it's a variable, to evaluate that variable, look it up in the environment. And so we have these rules stipulating if that v is not in variables, because we don't want to accidentally have an x sitting there, because we want to look it up. We want to see what the value is. So it might seem a little odd, or maybe it doesn't, to not
make this distinction between something that we're about to evaluate and something we've already evaluated. But something that turns out to be very nice about this formulation is that if we view M and E as sort of a combination of things, as in some sense as our closure, as if we, in other words, if we substituted everything that's in our environment back into M, we'd sort of get back, in some sense, the original term that we would have in our lambda calculus. And this K over here, this corresponds exactly to that E that I was talking about before, that evaluation context. And so we can have this very tight correspondence between these lambda expressions in our lambda calculus and these triples in our, that are characterized by the CK machine. So in terms of this theoretical implementation, I can then implement on top of it, okay, my debugger. This is, again, the whole thing. Okay, and we can go ahead and take a look at a few of what these rules, what are they saying. One thing that I've added here that we didn't see in the specification is that sometimes I want to tag the continuation, tag the runtime stack, with a little D to indicate that I want to go into debug mode. So here, if I've got a value, and again, the value isn't a variable, because I want to make sure to evaluate the variable, and I have this D, I want to jump into my debugger and land so that I'm sitting right after this value. Okay. But otherwise, here we are, and we can see that these rules are kind of similar. So here we are, if I'm sitting in my debugger, I'm before an application. What happens is, here's the dot over here by the M, and I've pushed this frame onto the stack. Okay. If I've got this dot before a value, and I take a step, okay, you notice I didn't modify anything over here, but I modified the continuation, so in effect, this D in some sense corresponds, in some sense, to having a dot after, right after the V, and then the environment, the evaluation context surrounding this V. Okay. Also over here with next, similarly, if I've got a dot in front of some term, and I take a, and I want to do a next, then I just add this D to tag my stack frame, and that way I'll know once I'm through evaluating this M, I'll know to go back into the debugger, and in that way I can run at full speed, right? So I'm not playing this game where I'm doing a bunch of steps. Rather, I'm running at full speed, and when I hit this tag on the continuation, then I pop back into my debugger. Professor Klinger.
On that first rule, I don't see a rule that M is the case where V is a variable. Is that something you just left off of the slide, or is that on another slide?
So you'll notice if there's no dot over here, I'm imagining that I'm actually running in the normal way. And you'll notice this arrow here isn't labeled with a step or a next.
Right.
So if this is a variable, it's on the previous slide. So in fact, I can prove that this theoretical implementation actually exactly implements that specification that I mentioned in the couple of slides ago. And the proof uses mathematical induction, structural induction. And I'm not going to go through the proof here. I don't even go through the proof in the paper. But what I would like to do is go through and put the rules side by side so that you can see they really are saying the same thing. Okay. So to give you an intuitive feel that these rules and this theoretical implementation really is correct.
Okay, so here's step. Okay. And you'll see here's the specification part. Here's the CEK implementation part. Specification part, CEK implementation part. Okay. And you can see that these are saying the same thing. So here's this E that corresponds to this K over here. Okay. Here the dot is in front of this application. Okay. When we take the step over here, the dot is in front of the M. When we take the step over here, the dot is in front of the M. Okay. Here we've pushed this frame onto the stack. Okay. And in some sense, you can see that if we're just focusing on the dot M, that we've expanded our evaluation context so that we are, in some sense, an E prime would be something with a hole right here with this N. And that's exactly what's going on over here in terms of why that got expanded. Okay. Over here, we have the dot in front of the V. We have the dot after the V. Here we have the dot in front of the V. Here we added this annotation to the continuation, in effect, saying the same thing as having the dot after the V. Okay, here we have a dot after the V, and it moves over to the dot in front of the M. Okay, here's the dot after the V, and in effect, you can see it moves to a dot in front of the M. Okay, so you can also see that this evaluation context here, this K corresponds to the E on the outside. K corresponds to the E on the outside. That hasn't changed. But we can see that something has shifted a little bit insofar as here we're thinking of the whole being over here and this M sitting here, and now we're thinking of the whole being here and having this V over here. So this V corresponds here, and we're imagining a whole. Okay. Similarly, if we have the dot after this constant here, it moves after to the value that this evaluates to. Here, if we have the dot after here, it moves after what it evaluates to. Okay. If we have the dot after the V here, it moves in front of this N over here, where this N is where we imagine substituting. So in the CEK machine, we don't do the substitution. Rather, we extend the environment. Okay. So you can read this colon as a cons. Okay, so here's the variable. Instead of explicitly substituting, we're binding it to VE. So everything in the CEK machine is essentially a closure. So here's this VE that gets bound to X. We're extending the environment in this way, and now we're sitting in front of the M, the body of our lambda expression, body of our abstraction. Okay, so I hope, sort of going through this, I've convinced you that these rules really do seem to be saying the same thing. Okay, this is not the formal proof, this is the intuitive argument. This is correct. And similarly, we can go through and look with next to play that same game in terms of what does the specification say? What does the rule say? Are they really saying the same thing? It's pretty darn close. So here's the dot in front of the M. K is the E. Okay. The dot's after the V. So here we have this M. It's going to be evaluated. And this D at the end is going to put a dot after the whatever value that evaluates to. Okay. And so on. Okay. So that's the theoretical side of things. But hey, let's have some implementation stuff. So I'm still going to be using some of the language, some of the sort of theoretical type language to describe the practical implementation side of things. But I'll also talk about how I implemented this. So I felt a little bit funny about the CEK machine. The nice aspect was that it made it easy to prove things because we have the K that corresponded to the evaluation context and so on. So here, it's not quite as nice in that regard. However, I make a distinction between what I'm
evaluating and the results that come back. So the reason why I call this RK is the R is for these results that come back that are sitting over here on this side. And the K is the continuation again. And that encapsulates everything. So over here, I have this eval continuation, eval stack frame that says if I want to evaluate a constant, okay, I just push that onto the results. If I want to evaluate a variable, I look the variable up in the environment and push that onto the results. If I want to evaluate a lambda expression, an abstraction, I push a closure onto the results. Okay. If I want to evaluate an if, then what I need to do is evaluate the test expression and have a continuation, an if continuation, where if the expression evaluated to true, if the result was true, then the if continuation evaluates the consequent, and if it evaluated to false, it evaluates the alternative. Okay. So you can see how this abstract machine works. And it's not hard to implement this. The way that I chose to implement this was to have records for these stack frames, and in some sense to be object-oriented and have a function associated with each of these stack frames that says what to do. All right, so I have an eval continuation action that says what to do if I encounter an eval stack frame, an eval continuation, and so on. So all I have to do is to make this go is to apply the function that's in the frame to these pieces, that is the continuation and the results. The whole thing just goes. Okay. So what about the debug portion? And what I would just like to point out is that I can write rules very similar to my CEK rule. So now here I alternate CEK rules and RK rules. So my CEK machine was very handy for proving the correctness. And now I can write very similar rules. Before I had this rule over here where I said, okay, if I have a D mark on my continuation and the V is an n variables, that what that turns into is pops me in the debugger where I'm sitting after the V. Okay, over here, I no longer need to make this distinction about whether V is in variables or not because I have results here, then it's guaranteed not to be a variable. Okay, so if I have result, have a debug mark on the continuation, pops me into the debugger sitting after that result. Okay, if I'm before a value, take a step, simply mark the continuation. Okay, over here, same sort of thing. If I'm going to be evaluating a value and I'm sitting here in the front in the debugger, what happens when I take a step? I just mark that continuation right here with a D. So you can see these rules are very similar. Okay. So the CK, the theoretical implementation, gave me the insight, what do I need to do to make this a practical implementation? Okay. I just write these very similar rules. Over here, just one more. If I'm sitting after a value and I'm about to evaluate this application, okay, basically the same kind of game. Okay, what I want to do is move in front of the body. Okay, over here, it's more complicated because I'm allowing for a more realistic situation. That is, I'm allowing for multiple arguments, right, instead of just one. Right, so here I am. I'm sitting. I've got the closure here. I've got all the rest of the results that I'm going to be applying. Okay. And I've got this last result over here, and I've got a dot at the end. So I'm sitting in the debugger right after the last result. Okay. And so what that takes me to is sitting in front of M, again, where the environment has been extended. Okay. So very similar kinds of rules. So the CK theoretical implementation gave me insight into how to go ahead and implement it in maybe a slightly more realistic abstract machine, which is actually implemented and available on my webpage.
Okay, but wait a second. When we started off, I had a slide very similar to this, because we usually write interpreters like this and not like what I showed you a moment ago. We usually don't write an abstract machine to write an interpreter. We have something like this instead, where we go through, okay, I have a constant, I apply the continuation to it, okay, I have a variable, I go ahead and look it up, and so on. So this looks more like what we were doing before. Okay. This is what we were doing originally rather than this whole game with abstract machines. Can we still take the insights we've learned from the CK machine and then moving that to the RK machine? Can we use that to understand how to write an interpreter with a debugger so that we can write the interpreter like this instead rather than having to implement this abstract machine, which is maybe a little bit weird? And we can. And when writing it in this way, I want to shift paradigm. So before, the paradigm that I was using is the operational semantics, so-called. And now I'm going to shift and talk about a sort of a denotational style. And again, in presenting the implementation, there's an actual implementation, which this is a snippet from. I can't just sit and show you the whole listing, that would take too long, but if we're just restricting ourselves to the lambda calculus, I can show you the whole thing in a couple of slides, the whole thing. Okay, so for the top part, here's the interpreter. So if I'm interpreting a constant, I continue with the constant. If I'm interpreting a variable, the row is the environment. I continue with the value of the variable. If I'm interpreting an abstraction, I have this. And the thing that's unusual here is I have this iota here and then this iota over here. So this is a little bit funny. And then if I have an application, okay, well, I need to interpret or evaluate the first thing in my application, and then I need to evaluate the second thing, and then actually do the call. And in terms of what does this dot mean, I'm going to say what this dot means, I'm going to introduce this B here, where this B means I'm sitting before M, where there's this row and this environment and this continuation. Okay. And in effect, although it's written in a different style, it's basically saying the same thing. Okay, so if I'm sitting in front of a value like a constant or a variable or an abstraction, a lambda expression, what this says is, if I take a step, then I'm going to be sitting after it. If I take a step, I'm going to be sitting after what it evaluates to. If I take a step, I'm going to be sitting after, this A is for after what it evaluates to. Okay, with next, if I'm sitting before some arbitrary term and I do a next, what happens is I go ahead and run my expression in my interpreter, and the continuation that I provide is that I say, after I'm done, what I want to do with the value is I want to say that I'm sitting after that value. Okay, so it's saying exactly the same thing, I'm just using a different language to express it. Okay. Okay, so just quickly, let me just quickly show you after, because that's the whole thing. Okay, so here's after. Okay, and the unusual aspect over here is that I'm dispatching on the kind of continuation that I have. Okay, so this M over here is not a variable, it's actually a constant. Okay, and you can see that if I'm sitting after a value, okay, and I want to take a step, and I have this particular kind of continuation, what happens is that the regular interpreter turns into a before interpreter. Okay, that's why I had that iota over there. So with this before interpreter, that's going to put me sitting right in front of the body. Okay, so that's the situation where I've got a dot after the last value in an application. So what this is going to put me in front of, this B is going to put me in front of the body of the abstraction. Okay. So let me just leave it at that for the moment, since we're running short on time. And simply comment that the actual code, this has all been implemented, the actual code is sitting available on my website if you want to check it out and try it out. And that's all. Thank you. Surely.
Right, so basically, you convinced me that your specification is correct. However, it is not obvious to me at first glance that the specification is complete. What I mean by that is that given whatever starting position and whatever application of step next, how can I be sure that you're going to fall on the case that is handled by the specification? So in other words, I guess you have a proof of completeness as well as proof of correctness.
That's true. That it would be that is desirable. That's not in the paper. And in some sense, I think it amounts to sort of looking at different cases and seeing that nothing else can come up.
You can prove it formally, given all these equations.
Sure.
You can probably prove it formally.
Sure, sure.
Okay, but only you've not done it.
I didn't go through and do that proof, that's true.
Cool questions. I think it's the CEK implementation. I don't know if it matters very much, but isn't step just the same as eval, essentially? Except for the dots.
Yes, and that is a desirable property. That's what we want.
But step kind of steps into an evaluation, right?
So does eval.
Is it next?
Is there a one-to-one correspondence between the rules for eval and the rules for step?
Kind of. The thing is, let me see if we can put that one back up. Okay. So this sort of movement. Let me actually do the previous slide. Okay, so sometimes we have something like this rule over here, okay, where in some sense what we're doing in terms of step is just moving the dots around. So we're doing a little bit less than evaluation when we're doing step in some sense. Sometimes we're just moving the dot around a little bit rather than actually a piece of the computation. So in the paper I talk about this in the specification language, the specification, we can think about it as a language in and of itself that has dots in it. And how does this language correspond to our original language, our original lambda calculus without dots in it? And what I say is, okay, it's the same thing, what you're saying, it's the same thing with step, except that it could be that when we do one of these steps, we're just moving the dots around rather than any actual computation. So it's zero or one actual steps. Does that answer your question?
I guess maybe I have a meta question. You said the title's advice about debugger. Sorry, I haven't read the paper, but what is your advice about debugger instruction? Is this advice?
So I just intend the intention of this is to say, well, if you're one of those people who wants to write a debugger for an interpreter, here are some ideas that could be useful to you.
Okay. But somebody else might say, well, you know, take your definition of eval, and after every application of a rule, stick in a dot or something. You know, that would be advice. Not very formal, but very advisory.
I'm not quite.
Doesn't matter. So a couple of slides later, you had this notation. It was, you know, something or other, colon, colon, left bracket, right bracket. It's one of your machines, maybe the arcane machine. An arcane machine?
Yeah.
Minor question, just does left bracket, right bracket, is that sort of a stack variable? It looks like it means empty stack, but that can't be.
Over here. Yeah, so it's true that I'm overloading brackets. Okay, that in terms of evaluation context, so with the original lambda calculus, I'm using bracket, bracket as a whole. In terms of talking about these machines, I'm using brackets as list constructors. So I'm thinking of this as the empty list over here, and this as push it or consing something onto the empty list.
That's what I'm confused about. It seems to me like you should replace every occurrence of empty list here with, you know, a stack or a variable being any stack.
Oh, okay. So you say, hey, why is this all empty list right now?
Right.
And in some sense, the answer is right now I'm only allowing one value to get pushed on. So I could imagine a future.
So with continuation passing, you never need more than an empty stack.
In the future, the thought was maybe in the future we'd want to model multiple return values.
Okay.
Okay, but it's not there right now.